myth for everything we observed. Now we try to understand invisible stars with imaginary numbers on Euclidean curves. Math was easy when the world was flat. Progress, well, I wanna go back. Once upon a time, a bowl of leeches cured us of our every ill. No such thing as the uninsured. The poultry paid our doctor bills. Sicknesses were all the same. Progress, man. Simplicity's pain. Progress, man. I'm gonna find some moldy cave. Break up the big stalactite. Club a girl and take her home to breed a little tribe of troglodytes. Everybody knew you either hunted or died. Thinking man is crazy when we started to farm. And now we run a charity that serves worldwide. It's altruistic entropy. Progress, well, it isn't for me. Progress, man, I wanna go back. Progress, yeah, it's gotta be stopped. Time machine, 'cause a different age would suit me well. Send me back 4 billion years when everyone was single-celled.
Hi, once again, this is Rent Wheel, and you're listening to the Mideast Migraine Show. Brought to you by Free Radio Santa Cruz at 101.3 FM, streaming live also at, oh, who are we here? Streaming live at freakradio.org. Click on the red oval. It is 3:04 in the afternoon, Pacific Daylight Time. June the 2nd, 2014. If those facts jive with your own personal time-space continuity, then you know the show is live, and you may call in at any time. Don't worry about interrupting me or anything you hear. The phone number direct to me in the studio here. And I am alone, I am by myself, so you will go directly onto the air when you call. Phone numbers, area code 831-427-3772. Again, for this Monday edition of Mideast Migraines, phone number, area 831-427-3772. You may call for any reason that you feel important or pertinent to the subject matter, or perhaps to me personally, whatever that means. Okay. Going to take a brief moment to clean my glasses here. So what is the show about? It comes to you every Monday at 3 p.m. for a couple of hours, almost, on Free Radio Santa Cruz. There's also the weekend edition, the Saturday edition, at these same coordinates at 11 a.m. every Saturday. Saturday is the time and space when we do a book reading. The current book on the Saturday edition of Mideast Migraines is entitled They Dare to Speak Out. People and Institutions Confront Israel's Lobby, written by former Congressman Paul Finley, former Congressman of Illinois. But that is on the weekends. Now is the Monday edition, where I convey a bunch of other stuff, whether I get it from the internet or it's in some form of print, a little diatribe, or perhaps from a magazine or newspaper, some periodical. Pertinent stuff about the situation in Israel and Palestine. Oh, by the way, I happen to be the son of a Palestinian Christian man who was born and raised in Jerusalem. Decades before Palestine became the modern state of Israel. I think that pretty much tells you where I'm coming from, particularly if this is the first time you've tuned into this program. Actually, I've been making it a practice lately to branch out a bit, talk about stuff that is not related, or at least not directly related, to the situation in the proverbial Holy Land of Palestine, Israel. And I want to talk to you a bit, seeing as how tomorrow, Tuesday, June 3rd, is primary election day for 2014 here in California. Here's something that comes to us by way of Capital in Maine, Investigating Power in Politics. Capital in Maine is an online internet series of articles. Other than that, I don't know anything about where it comes from. These things just pop up sometimes in my inbox. I'm not even sure how they find out where I am, but isn't that the case with so much junk and spam out there? You never know exactly where they come from. But this is, I do not consider this to be either spam nor junk mail. Again, from Capital in Maine, Investing Power in Politics, written by Gary Cohn, C-O-H-N, Gary Cohn, updated April 16. The following story was reported by Capital in Maine as part of its California Exposé investigative series and published here in collaboration with the Huffington Post. Marin County is one of California's most liberal regions, and with its iconic redwoods and stunning coastline, it is also a power center for environmental activism. And so, in a bill to give the State Coastal Commission authority to levy fines against shoreline despoilers came for a vote in the State Assembly in 2013. It was taken for granted that Marin's new assemblyman, Mark Levine, would vote for passage. That didn't happen. Instead, the San Rafael Democrat sat out the single most important vote for his constituents that year, which helped doom the measure. But Levine was not finished. In Sacramento, he would abstain or skip votes. And please forgive me if you're not hearing my voice for extended periods. I edit some of this stuff to make it easier for me to read, as well as for other editing purposes. Lo and behold, sometimes when it comes out, though, it's like someone didn't re-ink the cartridge or something, even though this has nothing to do with the printer. I didn't print it. It's just that the letters and words are kind of dim. So once again, please bear with. Start the paragraph again. But Levine was not finished. In Sacramento, he would abstain or skip votes on bills helping farm workers and creating a Bill of Rights for domestic workers. He has also voted against legislation requiring economic impact reports for big box stores and requiring more rate increase disclosure from Kaiser Permanente. Kaiser Permanente, historically at least, is a big health care corporation. That Levine keeps at arm's length the progressive values of the 10th Assembly District, which includes much of equally liberal Sonoma County, should come as no surprise. During his two Assembly campaigns, he has received hundreds of thousands of dollars from some of the state's largest business interests. Hmm. What is baffling is that Levine, who declined to comment for this article, is neither a dino, D-I-N-O, a conservative who is a Democrat in name only, nor a farm belt centrist. He remains committed. He remains a committed suburban liberal. One, that is, who happened to attend a local Mitt Romney rally in 2012 and who felt at ease appearing at a Republican Lincoln dinner last year. Levine is also no aberration. Rather, he is part of a new breed of Democrat, one exceedingly attentive to big business while tone-deaf toward the Democratic Party's traditional base, which includes union workers, environmentalists, and public school advocates. Okay, why am I having difficulty here? I'm just trying to do something on my pewter. Democratic Party's traditional base, which includes union workers, environmentalists, and public school advocates. At the very moment that California's Republican Party is melting into electoral irrelevancy, Levine and other hybrid Democrats are appearing in all corners of the state. Their ranks include Bill Dodd, a Napa County supervisor and a former Republican who is running as a Democrat for a Wine Country Assembly seat, and Palmdale Assemblyman Steve Fox, another erstwhile Republican. Fox, who says he is proud to have earned the California Chamber of Commerce's highest approval rating for a Democrat, tells Capital in Maine that the Democratic Party's becoming friendlier to business is a positive development. "We're pulling the party to the center, towards being more business-friendly," Fox says. Yep. Then there's Orinda City Councilman Steve Glazer. Orinda is on the East Bay there, not terribly far from Oakland, California. Steve Glazer, a former top advisor to Governor Jerry Brown, who recently worked as a consultant to the California Chamber of Commerce and its Jobs Political Action Committee. Glazer is currently running for an Alameda County Assembly seat and has fiercely challenged the right of transit workers to strike. "I am trying to redefine what it means to be a Democrat," Glazer told Capital in Maine. "I think you can be a financial conservative and be a strong Democratic officeholder." The rise of what might be called the corporate Democrat can only be partly explained by shrinking GOP delegations in Sacramento. It is also the product of redistricting and effects of the, quote, top two primary, by which members of the same political party can win the top two primary positions and then face off in November. These two structural changes were approved by voters in, respectively, 2008 and 2010. Since then, powerful corporations, agricultural associations, and other political high rollers have been turning away from their traditional Republican partners and placing more and more of their chips on the Democratic end of the table, specifically on candidates like Mark Levine. These changes are only now catching the attention of Democratic electeds and activists who see a coming fight for the soul of their party. Quote, "Democrats, we are just as guilty of getting sucked into the influence of money and power about which we criticize Republicans," state controller candidate Betty Yee told Democrats at the party's annual state convention last month. Yee, who is a member of the State Board of Equalization, expanded on her wake-up call in an interview. "What's different now is the wholesale moderation of Democratic positions on issues we used to own, education, income equality, and poverty," says Yee. Yee says, "Those issues don't rate high on the bucket lists of the corporations and millionaires now backing friendly Democratic candidates. Campaign contribution records maintained by California's Secretary of State reveal a dense constellation of wealthy backers of candidates such as Levine, Glazer, Dodd, and Fox. In the 2014 election cycle, these benefactors form a who's who of developers, gaming concerns, big pharma, and agribusiness, and their largesse often overlaps their political, and their largesse often overlaps across political races. Both Levine and Glazer, for example, have received top dollar from Los Angeles billionaire Ellie Broad, Pacific Gas and Electric, PG&E, Time Warner, Walmart, Safeway, and other pharmaceutical titans as Eli Lilly and Pfizer. Sorry, just relax. Lost my place here. Very easy to do on this machine. Do a little tap dance here. Okay, and blah 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 blah. Both Levine and Glazer, for example, have received top dollar from Los Angeles billionaire Eli Broad, PG&E, Time Warner, Walmart, Safeway, and other pharmaceutical titans as Eli Lilly and Pfizer. Levine, Glazer, and Dodd count as patrons Walmart heiress Carrie Walt and Penner, San Francisco magnate Joseph O. Tobin II, the California Chamber of Commerce, public pension reform advocate David Crane, Gap Store's Skion William S. Fisher, and Basic American Foods heir George Yoon. Meanwhile, former Los Angeles Mayor Richard Reardon has contributed to both Levine and Dodd's campaigns, while PricewaterhouseCoopers, the California Real Estate PAC, Political Action Committee, money grabber, and the California Forestry Association PAC are among those donating to both Levine and Fox. And Levine, Glazer, and Fox all receive funds from AT&T's Political Action Committee. This donor list represents only a selection of contributors who have donated money through mid-April of this year. The number of donors and the amount of campaign spending will only increase as the June primary nears, and then afterwards, leading up to the November runoffs. Quote, "What business is doing is coming to terms with the new structure of politics in California," says Rafael Sonnenschein, Executive Director of the Edmund G. Pat Brown Institute for Public Affairs at California State University, Los Angeles. The top two primary system really opens the door to be able to support business-friendly Democrats, end quote. Fernando Guerra, a political science professor and director of the Thomas and Dorothy Levy Center for the Study of Los Angeles at Loyola Marymount University, agrees. "This new environment," says Guerra, "where Democrats are very dominant and with new electoral laws allows for a strategy for electing moderate Democrats in districts particularly defined as liberal-leaning districts." Indeed, a recent University of Southern California, USC study found that the electoral reforms in California are associated with an ideological shift toward the center for Democrats, which is to say, in a rightward direction. And California state legislature, with no perceptible move to the center from the Republican Party. Except perhaps from Republicans who have simply switched parties. The legislative effects of such defections have yet to be gauged. It's something that may look as though I switched my party so I can run for this seat, admits Bill Dodd, the former Republican who is running for the 4th Assembly District seat. Nothing could be further from the truth. I fit comfortably under the Democratic tent, end quote. Still, when asked whether he has a better chance of winning the Assembly seat by running as a Democrat, Dodd doesn't hesitate with his answer. Clearly, he acknowledges, if you look at the registration in the district and the history of the races, this district is a predominantly Democratic-leaning district, end quote. Dodd is sitting on a campaign war chest of nearly $528,000, which eclipses even Levine's huge treasury. Dodd's contributions come mainly from wineries and other businesses, as they have since his first supervisorial role in 2000. Then Dodd was a political novice in the chamber. Then Dodd was a political novice and, quote, the Chamber of Commerce candidate, end quote, as James Conaway described him in The Far Side of Eden, Conaway's book about development in the Napa Valley. Yet Dodd also boasts deep funding from individuals who, like David Crane, are influential advocates of cutting public employee pensions, or like Greg and Carrie Penner, are wealthy supporters of school privatization, views that run counter to longstanding Democratic Party positions. In 2012, the California Chamber of Commerce and other business groups played a key role in targeting a pair of progressive, pro-labor, Democratic incumbents in two liberal districts. In Northern California, Mark Levine narrowly defeated Michael Allen, while in the 50th Assembly District, which includes Santa Monica, challenger Richard Bloom squeaked by Betsy Butler. Levine and Bloom, who was then mayor of Santa Monica, Bloom, were widely considered friendlier to business than Allen and Butler. Those are two shining examples of candidates that might not have been elected pre the top two primary systems, says Franklin Gilliam Jr., Dean of the University of California, Los Angeles's Luskin School of Public Affairs. The USC study similarly pointed to these races, adding that, quote, Levine supported the Cal Chamber in 43% of votes, which is high for a Democratic legislator. In fact, the chamber's jobs pack had paid at least $100,000 for polling and mailers that were used to attack Allen and Butler. A group affiliated with the Western Growers Association was heavily involved with the attack mailers, which played a role electing Levine and Bloom. It's not unusual for big business to hedge its bets by contributing to liberal candidates. Likewise, the mere acceptance of corporate money doesn't guarantee a candidate will always vote business's way. What raises eyebrows about corporate Democrats, however, is the preponderance of corporate money in their coffers, which more resemble the treasuries of traditional Republican candidates than of progressives. At first glance, corporate Democrats may not seem to be conservative surrogates, thanks to their votes for causes dear to progressives and because of the ratings they receive from liberal activist groups. To look at the high rankings, often in the 90 to 100 percentiles, bestowed by environmental organizations, reproductive rights groups, and unions, and correspondingly low scores from, say, conservative tax organizations and gun lobbyists, corporate Democrats have little trouble appearing to be pragmatists who are forced by circumstances to stand up to their party's base for the common good in California. Yet the fact remains that California is the most progressive state in the nation, governed by the most progressive wing of a Democratic Party that has discovered its Sacramento supermajority is not so super. And then parenthetically, it says, What's stopping the state from enacting more visionary legislation than it has since 2012? Or from offering its low-income workforce a higher minimum wage than $10 an hour and sooner than 2016? Unlike Washington, D.C., where progressive reforms have been thwarted by a determined conservative opposition, in California, that opposition comes from within. And voting records show this opposition does not necessarily exercise power in obvious ways. We're getting to the end, folks. Hang in there. Once elected, corporate Democrats don't always flex their muscle by openly sponsoring or supporting business-friendly bills, but sometimes by doing nothing, by abstaining from voting on bills that business opposes. I'll read that sentence again. Once elected, just so I, as well as all of you out there, can understand. Once elected, corporate Democrats don't always flex their muscles by openly sponsoring or supporting business-friendly bills, but sometimes by doing nothing, by abstaining from voting on bills that business opposes. A single abstention can mean life or death for a measure that requires a supermajority to pass. The bill to give enforcement powers to the Coastal Commission, AB 976, for instance, died after Levine and several other Democrats abstained on the final vote. The same thing happened to AB 880, the Walmart loophole bill, which received 46 aye votes, with 27 lawmakers voting against it and 6 abstaining. A total of 54 ayes, or a two-thirds supermajority, was required. A total of 54 ayes and only got 46 aye votes. Although Levine voted yes, 3 other Democrats voted against the bill, while 5 more abstained. The California Chamber candidly acknowledges the importance of persuading Democrats to abstain from voting as part of its strategy to defeat bills which the business contingent in Sacramento opposes. In its website recap of legislators' 2013 voting records, the chamber notes, in a section titled "When Not Voting Helps," says this: sometimes a legislator is unwilling to vote against a colleague, but is willing to support the Cal Chamber's opposition to a bill. In such cases, a legislator may abstain from voting, which will hinder passage of a bill, just as a no vote does, is what it says there. Kenneth Burt, who was taught as a visiting scholar at the University of California at Berkeley's Institute of Governmental Studies, agrees that the chamber has been increasingly involved in trying to elect Democrats who are aligned with big business interests. Burt adds that this process has accelerated since the 2010 passage of another ballot initiative, Proposition 25, which allows a simple majority vote to pass the state budget. And by the way, Capital & Main here offers this disclosure. Burt also serves as the political director for the California Federation of Teachers, which is a financial supporter of Capital & Main. They're thoughtful enough to put that disclosure in. Finishing up this article here, quote, Prop 25 eliminated the ability of a few Republicans to demand additional tax breaks for big business as the price of passing a budget, Burt says. As a result, the chamber can no longer get its Republican allies to hold hostage the whole legislative process. Loyola Marymount's Fernando Guerra, I believe the name was, foresees consequences for progressive initiatives in California that are more profound than the loss of one-party supermajority. I could see, Gara says, in the future, most three parties in California, Republicans, the liberal progressive wing of the Democratic Party, and moderate Democrats. Oh, these darn faded letters here. Let me reread that sentence again. I could see, Gara says, in the future, almost three parties in California. Almost three parties in California. Republicans, comma, the liberal progressive wing of the Democratic Party, comma, and moderate Democrats. Such a tectonic divide may already be in motion. Okay, well, you know, if I had read this article in its entirety before I went on the air with it, I probably wouldn't have read it. It has nothing to do with whether or not I agree with it. Fully appreciating all the aspects of what it talks about obviously requires people, the reader, to be really up on their California politics, and also, I would say, to be up on the mechanics of voting in Sacramento. This is a guy, the author here, Greg Cohn, obviously is really into this stuff, and I was prompted to read it again because of the proximity of today to tomorrow's election. Only a primary election that it is, but this is an even-numbered year, which is not exactly an off-voting year, and not an off-electoral year, as odd-numbered years are in the current setup. But the given the title of this thing, In Plain Sight, The Rise of Corporate Democrats in California, at least he gets the point across to us, dimmer of wit perhaps, readers, that you really cannot go by the name of a particular party. Not that I ever do that when I'm in the polls. But you can't just go by party affiliation alone to determine who the good guys are and to distinguish them from the not-so-good guys. The influence is very broad, and I think a power structure which is far older than democracy, namely the ones with the big guns and the big monies knowing how to influence the more popular figureheads in power, in government, in positions of tribal or clan leadership, whatever. They run the show. Big business runs the show. They know how to divvy their money out to this candidate or that candidate, whether they have Dem or Rep or a D or R following or in front of their name. Okay, let's get back to the fun stuff, namely Palestine, Israel. Dr. Mazin Kumsieh, has a piece here about the launch of the Palestine Museum of Natural History and studying the biodiversity of Palestine. Let's see where the actual... article here is. Let's go ahead and try the video and see if that does anything for us here. Hopefully it's in English.
يعني فكرة عمل متحف تاريخ طبيعي فلسطيني هو لدراسة التنوع الحيوي في فلسطين.
Okay, I'm going to play this video and just read you the subtitles. At least we'll have music and some sensation of Arabic being spoken in the background. It's tiny screen. I don't know what's going on here. Usually here. Okay, here's the full screen. Okay, and here we go. The idea of the Palestinian Museum of Natural History is to study the biodiversity in Palestine. Shot here of the lovely scenic hills of Palestine. I'm amazed that we live in these areas and we do not know anything about them. So I encourage people to get out and explore their surroundings. We need them to volunteer to come, and we are ready to take them to those areas. The study of biodiversity in Palestine. We in Palestine have a very important and beautiful nature because we are between three continents, Asia, Africa, and Europe. Topographically, Palestine has a range of climates, including the lowest region on Earth, and also possesses the mountains like Jabal al-Sheikh. As a result, the diversity of animals and plants in Palestine is large. My late uncle Sana Atala was the first native biologist to study animals of Palestine. He intended to build a Palestinian Museum of Natural History, and we would like to complete the work he began, and this will take time. I and some students, like Michael Salsa and Ibrahim Salman, in this trip, go to the field, and this is maybe trip number 80 in the last 2 years to study fauna, collect, take photos, observe. Looks vaguely like certain parts of California, and to publish research. For example, we published a research paper about scorpions of Palestine, and we would like to publish about snakes and other animals. At Navi Sareh village, Central West Bank, the residents conduct a weekly protest against the Israeli wall and settlements built on their land. This peaceful march is faced by Israeli soldiers' violence.
You know that he could not give you any reason for what he doing here.
I mean, the smell is inside the house. The windows of this house are broken.
So already we're talking about an overlap between a natural history museum and the oppression of Israel against native Palestinians. They're kibitzing here with the soldiers. I'm just waiting for a new translation on the bottom of the screen here. Now they're collecting in the field, including a man holding a proverbial butterfly net. The idea of the Palestinian Museum of Natural History is to study the biodiversity in Palestine. It says here, published on the topic and educate Palestinians about the importance of nature and how to protect it, especially in light of colonial settlements expansion on the land of Palestine. Biodiversity is very important for the environment and for humans, even our breathing. Because nature produces oxygen, which we breathe. Trees and plants, of course, are the lungs of the earth. Cutting off trees in Palestine lands tends to lead to adverse climate change. Even agriculture would become impossible, so we must care for and protect biodiversity. We, in the modest and small beginning, do some studies. The nature of our work includes field trips, work in laboratory, and museum work. The basic thing is the field trips and documenting where these animals are, occasionally collecting some samples and record existence and what they eat and how they live, and study the ecosystem where they live. A strange grasshopper. Bring a box, he says. Tells the kids. A strange grasshopper. How strange can they get? Now they're inside a rather primitive structure. It could just be the basement of a house, but actually I don't think it's the basement of a built structure above it. The idea here that we walk about 5 or 7 steps, then we put a trap and remember its place. Very basic, simple description of what it's like. There is a line, and it is better that this line is in an area that has rodent signs. Hide the trap, but not too much. You want, after all, you want the animal to find it. If we split and I walk, for example, in that direction inside while Ibrahim walks there. So we cover 2 areas. Okay, I'm falling asleep almost, so I'm going to skip way ahead here. See if anything really develops. Now they're inside what looks like either a laboratory or an institution of learning. They have samples that they've picked up in the fields. What we mostly need now is volunteer people interested in Palestine's ecology, nature, species, fauna, or flora. Science is about people and not buildings or materials. Okay. Let us escape from the large screen here. What I'm getting out of this video presentation here, and it is on YouTube, again, with the title Studying the Biodiversity of Palestine in English. It is subtitled in English, and they're speaking Arabic, of course. I can see, even though I'm sure the individuals who were featured in this film and the ones who were doing most of the talking have a genuine interest in this subject matter, in pursuing this as a life's work. There's also a demonstration in the film of how the constant and rapid expansion of Jewish settlements into Palestine, which, just as it sounds, is not legal by international law. It's not proper. It's not ethical. All before the official establishment and recognition of the state of Palestine, with these Jewish settlements expanding and expanding, it's wrecking the nature of the area, cutting down trees, impinging upon natural biodomes. Is that the right word? Bio niches, and this is actually just another way in which Israel is eliminating the culture and the interests and even the very land of Palestine itself for the purpose of bringing in more and more Jewish people and allowing them to subdue all of native Palestine. That's what I'm getting out of this, folks. Okay, now how do I... Yeah, once you've got a video here, it can be real hard to... Oh, boy. Okay. God, I wish I can get rid of this. There is an X. No. Oh, how I wish I could... Back to what... Okay. I'm trying to get back to the Cumcier article, which is extremely difficult. I know. Let's have a little more Stuart Davis music. Take a musical break. It's 3:46 Pacific Daylight Time here on the Mideast Migraine Show, Free Radio Santa Cruz.
types are so misunderstood. While everyone's a critic, they don't know when something's good. Just let us have our space and freedom to create. And when the work is finished, we'll tell you if it's great. My painter friend is Stefan. I'm screwing his wife Mia. Well, no, it doesn't bother him. In fact, it's his idea. You common people try to pass it off as sick behavior, but it's how he gets inspired. I'm doing him a favor. Artists want to share their gift. It's often that they can't. Thank God that Stefan finally got that NEA grant. Stefan's exhibition is a masterpiece to see. It's a series done in oil of his wife in bed with wild positions all throughout his home. We cluttered every room with empty tubes of paint and foam. He's done good work before, but this is closer to his heart. I'm glad that I can help out my friend Stefan with his art. Now Stefan was a prodigy and growing up was odd. Like Mapplethorpe multiplied by Marquis de Sade. Discovered porno, he was instantly consumed, and he fell in love with Mia, and his art began to bloom. Congress tried to pull his funding, as his approach is raw. Well, technically, in many states, it is against the law. You know the one of Mia with the gerbil in her hand? It's called the veterinarian, it goes for 30 grand.
Back at you again here. Let's just do the print version of this, which accompanies the video. It's actually led off by the video. Again, this is Mazin Kumsieh's blog. Dr. Mazin Kumsieh was Palestinian. As from 2 days ago, May 31st, launch of the Palestine Museum of Natural History. He says, first, a clarification. Our last message mentioned that Peres and Netanyahu are two atheists who still think God gave them this land. This was in no way indicating we have problems with atheists, or prefer the term, secular humanists. I was mentioning it to show the hypocrisy of these particular atheists. Okay, in reference to an earlier statement, Professor Kumsieh said, now for launch of Palestine Museum of Natural History, the PMNH. Yesterday I signed a memorandum of understanding with Bethlehem University to institutionalize the Palestine Museum of Natural History. PMNH, in the unofficial capacity, accomplished a lot in the past few years, but now will quickly become the premier institution in the Arab world, with high-caliber research, education, and service relating to biodiversity and environmental conservation. In the agreement on my end, my family donates $250,000, $250,000 for interim operational costs, and we also bring in collections and our free work. Over 10 volunteers. The university provides space and infrastructure support up to $45,000 for the interim period of 5 years. Together, we will work to build it. Some 30 key people, including some of our volunteers, attended the signing ceremony. This was a historic day, but the work is just beginning. Below is my short speech at the event on behalf of the volunteers. Please read it, as we will need your support. Aha. You do not have to have a biology or nature background to join or to help. Merely interest. First, you may join us in a separate electronic group that will deal with environmental and biodiversity issues in Palestine. Email me to indicate you would like to join this nature list. Joining the list is not a commitment to help, but a commitment to be informed and get involved. We also welcome donations through the Bethlehem University Foundation in the United States or directly to BU. Please indicate on your donation it is for the History Museum, and let me know that you have sent it. Here is the talk by Professor Mazin Kumsieh at signing ceremony for the Palestine Museum of Natural History, 30 May 2014. That would be last Friday. This day is of historical significance. I want to start on behalf of current museum volunteers and researchers by thanking all of you, university administrators, Brother Peter, Brother Stefan, Dr. Irene, Chris, volunteers, co-workers, my family, and all others who made this day possible. To my wife, Jessie, and son, Danny, without you, none of this would be possible. We started with a vision by my uncle Sana Atala 50 years ago and now moved to a collective vision by many people. On his summer visits to Palestine, he would take me and other children to the field. I was impressed as a child by his dedication, love of nature. When he died at age 27, I promised to finish the work he planned to do. One of those was to research mammals in the Arab world and thus publish 2 books and over 70 papers on mammals. There are still more coming. We are now working on new data for bats. But the other dream was a museum to serve Palestine. While we had opportunities with non-governmental organizations or a new NGO, it was clear to all concerned that this needs to be integrated with teaching and research at the university, which intends to dramatically improve education, research, and service over the next few years, incorporating this project in other projects. 2 example areas that will revolutionize biology and related areas are biodiversity and biotechnology, including human genetic health, etc. We are fortunate to have experience in both, and in many ways we can also integrate them together, for example, using DNA for systematics and taxonomy of animals and plants. Bethlehem University Cytogenetics Lab was the first lab to publish peer review work on genotoxic effects of Israeli industrial settlements. The first to publish data on causes of male infertility in Palestine. I presume they're talking about male humans there. The first to study chromosomes of Palestinian scorpions. 2 papers with undergraduates, the first to study amphibians in the West Bank and more. We have an excellent study of the fauna of Wadi al-Kuf, the first Palestinian-administered natural park, and we showed surprising new records. We have started strong, and none of our previous achievements could have been done without your support. But it was clear that we could do more when we create a museum of natural history by world standards. This is where it gets interesting. Palestine faces many challenges, such as overpopulation, colonization, global warming, and environmental degradation. We collectively plan to create a significant research, service, teaching, and development museum for Palestine and beyond to address some of these challenges. We have plans for over 10 sections of this museum by the end of our 5-year development phase. They include sections for museum administration, including accounting and development, sections for entomology, arachnology, spiders, herpetology, I believe herpetology refers to reptiles, perhaps most notably snakes, ornithology, birds, mammalogy, mammals, malacology, theses all focus on different groups of animals. Plant systematics, paleontology, having a lot to do with fossils, including of distinct animal species. Geology, public exhibits, including complete ecosystem demonstrations, and more. The $250,000 that my wife and I donated is a drop in the bucket compared to what is really needed to achieve this. But as Khalil Gibran said, you give but little when you give of your possessions. It is when you give of yourself that you truly give. For what are your possessions but things you keep and guard for fear you may need them tomorrow? And tomorrow, what shall tomorrow bring? To the overprudent dog burying bones in the trackless sand as he follows the pilgrims to the holy city. And what is fear of need but need itself? End of quotation by Khalil Gibran. So we will give much more in time and effort than anything else of ourselves. I am sure with your help and with the help of volunteers and co-researchers, as we publish more papers and demonstrate our capabilities, we will get the needed support to achieve the mission on the museum to research our natural world and use this knowledge to promote reasonable human interactions with our environment. And I'm just going to... Whoops. It's not helpful. We hope to move in the next 2 weeks to the location in Mar Andreas, and ahead of time I thank Dr. Musa and ICP for their cooperation, and we will collaborate as this is a community project. If we have on average 10 volunteers and researchers working with us the first year, 15 the second, then I'm sure we will publish more than 10 papers, and we will expand the collection in an accelerated rate, and we'll get the needed infrastructure and other support to succeed much more in the third year. An independent board will oversee this work, so this will be a team effort. It is not my project, but each of you is needed to be a partner to make this succeed. To do this, we will have a weekly gathering every Wednesday at 5 p.m. at the museum in Mar Andreas, starting July 2nd. These gatherings will involve an educational workshop, for example, on an environmental issue or on butterflies of Palestine, etc., and then followed by a meeting for practical planning for actions and growth. Participants will be issued certificates that will bear the logo of the Palestine Museum of Natural History and Bethlehem University. But I also promise you, we will have collaborations with several institutions, as we already did with ARIJ, A-R-I-J, can't remember what that stands for, with three other Palestinian universities, with EEC, with universities and institutions outside of Palestine, and more. We are talking to others in over 20 countries about collaboration and support. My collaboration will be coming, and this will be a priority to meet with key individuals, you and others, to work out the details. Again, we thank you for all you have done so far, but I will be meeting and asking for more help to make this a success for Palestine that we will all be proud of. Speech at the inauguration of... launch of the Palestine Museum of Natural History, given by Mazin Kumsieh, professor and director pro bono of the Palestine Museum of Natural History. Okay, just like being there, wasn't it? My oh-so natural and suave reading of his words. And at least we know that something is going on in Palestine that does not necessarily have so much directly to do with Palestinians peacefully protesting the expansion of Israeli Jews upon their land and the rest of the world shutting their eyes, certainly the United States by far shutting its eyes to Israel's encroachment on their own native peoples, just like the white Europeans did on the Native Americans of this North American continent and the South American continent, the Caribbean, places like Greenland. Oh yeah, it's the same thing. So, the Palestine Museum of Natural History. When I was in the Gaza Strip 5.5 years ago, I visited a very nascent archaeological museum, or perhaps I should say anthropological museum. One distinct room, very handsome displays, but all in Arabic, so I did not know what I was looking at. I was actually killing a lot of time standing around in the museum while higher-ups were doing kibitzing with the local leaders. That was in the Gaza Strip in 2008. God. Fascinating trip there. All right. I want to read this piece from the United Nations News Center. It's about Syria. UN News Center with breaking news from the UN News Service. This is actually dated May 28, 5 days ago. With Syria's culture near, quote, point of no return, UN agency to create safeguard observatory. Getting the main text here, pulling the main text up. From the United Nations News Center. I guess you wait too many days and it has a harder time finding these things. Okay, well, while we're waiting for that, It's not going to let me see anything right away here. So let's move on to something else. I apologize again. It's 4 minutes after 4 in the afternoon, 1604 hours, Pacific Daylight Time here on the west coast of North America. You're listening to the Mideast Migraine Show. That's what this mess is called. On Free Radio Santa Cruz, your community underground pirate radio service, an obvious and stalwart defiance of FCC regulation. We, Free Radio, are an ongoing expression of civil disobedience against the corporatization of commercial radio and likewise the corporate influence, as ultra powerful as it is, on the content a broadcast on such commercial stations. We stand distinctly apart and independent of that so-called quote-unquote legitimate activity. Let's try this one here. From Mondo Vice. The person who sent this to me says, they entitled this whole thing Israel Lobby Leaders, that is the Israel Washington representing Israeli concerns in Washington, D.C., are now confused about the topic of divestment. My friend writes, this is priceless and reads like parody. Quote, Jewish groups push back and fight for divestment from fossil fuels. Okay, let's just go right into the old Mondo Vice article here. And I really must remember to go into Facebook prior to beginning my show here at 3 o'clock every Monday. Or I guess we're... No. Try that. Ah, that's a relief. Okay, now let's see if... Okay, I'm into my Facebook account. Mondo Weiss, the war of ideas in the Middle East. Fearing divestment from Israel, Jewish organizations oppose divestment to halt global warming. What is this about? Picture of Richard Fulton here. Written by Philip Weiss on May 24. 9 days ago. Indeed, this is priceless and reads like parody. Quote, Jewish groups push back and fight for divestment from fossil fuel companies. Fear tactic could be used in Israel debate. Great reporting by Hadi Nems and Nathan Gutman at the Forward. That would be the Jewish Forward. Global warming, chopped liver. Iran's more of a problem. In interviews with the Forward, Jewish institutional leaders saw the issue as secondary to other global and social issues. Quote, we should be thinking of divestment only in terms of very extreme threats of the kind that Iran poses, said Richard Fulton, Director of National and Legislative Affairs at the American Jewish Community. I'm sorry, at the American Jewish Committee. Fulton was referring to mainstream Jewish communal support for divestment from companies doing business with Iran, whose development of its nuclear capabilities is viewed as a cover for developing nuclear weapons that would pose an existential threat to Israel. Reality check from the youth. Kara Kaufman, a 2012 graduate of Brown University and committed climate activist, sees this perspective as one bound to alienate younger Jews. What's the big fear? That divestment would be legitimized as a tool and would be turned on Israel. BDS really is marching. Jews urging such a move, divesting from fossil fuel companies, on national organizations face a formidable hurdle, the fear of legitimizing divestment as a tactic, considering its use by pro-Palestinian groups against Israel. In 2003, the Jewish Council for Public Affairs, an important mainstream Jewish umbrella group, adopted guidelines for judging boycott or divestment initiatives that urged avoiding them in most cases. The guidelines, which are still viewed as the communal standard for judging these initiatives, recommend avoiding boycotts, divestment, and economic sanctions because such measures could, and I quote, deny the Jewish community the higher moral ground in opposing boycotts against Israel or Jewish interests, end quote. Nems and Gutman noticed the hypocrisy. In the past, however, the Jewish community did not hesitate to use these very same investments as a tool to advance communal goals. Groups stood behind legislation imposing trade restrictions on the Soviet Union until Jews were allowed to leave the country. Some supported counter-boycotts against companies that adhered to the Arab boycott against Israel. And more recently, Jewish groups led calls to divest from Sudan because of genocide the Khartoum government was accused of committing in the country's Darfur region. Most noticeable today, however, is the campaign supported by a wall-to-wall coalition of Jewish groups to divest American funds from Iran. The difference this time? Some groups argue that fossil fuel is not a clear-cut case compared to previous campaigns, and the chances of it succeeded in bringing down carbon-emitting fuel companies are at best slim. But the concern about legitimizing the use of divestment, one of the three pillars of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement targeted at Israel in recent years, is ever present. The concern about legitimizing the use of divestment. That association got some traction recently during a debate over fossil fuel divestment at Swarthmore College. Quote, last year, there was a lot of agitation for companies to support Palestine and stop investing in companies having to do with Israel, end quote, Swarthmore board chairman Giles Kemp told the New York Times, explaining one factor in his school's rejection of the tactic. Quote, those students were as fervent in their cause as these students are in theirs. So the planet can go down the tube. Again, we see how corrupting Zionism is, destroying Jewish activism on a central issue for the human species. Namely, the JCPA, Jewish Council for Public Affairs, also operates the Coalition on the Environment and Jewish Life, but the council has yet to adopt a policy on fossil fuel divestment. Jared Feldman, the council's Washington director, expressed skepticism on the tactic's efficacy, saying, quote, instead of talking about divestment, we should see how far we can support development on alternative energy sources, Feldman says. Article ends with this sentence. I don't know what to say, but this wasn't in the Onion. Okay. Again, for many of us, rather hard to follow and appreciate, but when someone within the Jewish community starts talking about divestment, for their purposes, that tends to fly in the face of the efficacy, the morality, the goodness of the BDS movement against Israeli academic and cultural and some commercial organizations and interests. Okay. Oh, that's just my Facebook page. I'll get rid of that for now. Israel lobby leaders now confused about divestment. Should you support it or not? Okay. Grab some soothing cool beverage here. Nothing wrong with that. It's diet, after all. I salvage my throat here with a little Nutribiotic throat spray. We'll just let that percolate a little bit. Here's a piece of music from Stuart Davis entitled Noah's New Ark. Is it relevant or is it not relevant?
To be delivered from the cognitive pollution we've suffered through and lived among. Father, free us, intervene and lift the curse. Drench this tainted planet so our handicap can be reversed. And now below the bow we hear the panicked cries of dying men. Thrashing in the water, it's cutting off their oxygen. But we are spared, and providence will clearly show. All the meek inherit is the doom of their genetic code. The finger pointing came from God, finding his creation flawed. He decreed a final solution. Off you go, take a plunge. All of you have been expunged in the service of evolution. Our flagship embarks to populate a world with perfect genes. Where Noah's new ark, three standard deviations from the mean. So here we float, Mother Nature's second chance. It won't be long before the dove returns the olive branch. As for the dead, they only got what they deserved. It's all too obvious that God is grading on a curve. In his new kingdom, there isn't any simple need.
rich. We won't need janitors or Cretan drones to dig a ditch. We chosen girl, we'll sail ahead until we find the true potential in a cultivated human mind. An unencumbered tribe are we, devoid of mediocrity. Every blemish amended. All of us rejoice in some, are plotting to become a little smarter than the Lord intended. Our flagship embarks, populate a world with perfect genes, where Noah's new ark, three standard deviations from
Davis, Minnesota's very own Stuart Davis. I'm blowing my own head up here. I better turn down the old studio monitor. I'm generally adverse to using headphones. That's provided that there are any that are available. So I just like to hear my own voice through the box here. This is Ren to Wheel, and you're listening to the Mideast Migraine Show, the Monday, June 2nd, 2014 edition on Free Radio Santa Cruz at 101.3 FM and broadcasting on our online service at freakradio.org. Click the red oval for the streaming link. Let's see if it's worth getting into this now. I am going to do this piece from the UN News Center finally came up with Syria's culture, the country Syria, with Syria's culture near point of no return. United Nations agency to create safeguard observatory. May 28. In hopes of ebbing the cultural hemorrhage, quote unquote, in Syria, the United Nations Cultural Agency today announced that it will establish an observatory to monitor and access the state of Syria's cultural heritage, which is, quote, reaching the point of no return. Syria, of course, is in the middle of its, a good 3-year-plus civil war going on there. And it's more than just the lives of the people that are being lost and seriously damaged. Its cultural heritage is at stake. Continuing with this piece here. Based at its office in Beirut, Lebanon, the observatory will maintain an online platform where national and international stakeholders will share information on damaged structures, looted artifacts, and all forms of endangered and tangible heritage. Quote, in some areas we are reaching the point of no return where Syria's cultural heritage is concerned, cautioned Irina Bokova, Director General of the UN Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, UNESCO. The destruction of heritage represents a cultural hemorrhage in addition to the tragic humanitarian crisis and suffering experienced by the people of Syria, she added. In particular, Ms. Bakova highlighted the recent extensive damage to the historical synagogue of Eliyahu Hanabi in Damascus. The destruction of one of the oldest synagogues in Syria is a new blow against its religious and cultural heritage, which has already suffered tremendous damage, she said, referring in particular to the fact that Syria is host to highly significant monuments of Christian, Jewish, and Muslim faiths. This synagogue bears witness to the cultural diversity of Syria's history and to the potential of peaceful coexistence among all communities in the country, Ms. Bakova concluded. The decision to create the observatory was made at a UNESCO meeting entitled Rallying the International Community to Safeguard Syria's Cultural Heritage, attended by more than 120 experts from 22 countries to share information, devise policies, and improve cooperation during the conflict and beyond. Representatives of major international auction houses also took part in the meeting. In addition, the participants also called on the UN Security Council to consider a resolution to facilitate the restitution of stolen and illegally exported cultural objects from Syria and ban their sale and transfer. They also underline the need to, quote, demilitarize cultural sites, preventing their use as military bases or targets, in keeping with existing international law, notably the Convention for the Protection of Cultural Property in the Event of Armed Conflict, 1954, ratified by Syria. They also emphasize the need to train and raise awareness of police and customs officers in the region and beyond on their role in fighting illicit trafficking in cultural objects. The conflict in Syria has affected all six of its World Heritage sites. UNESCO reiterated, including through illicit excavation. The UN agency added that there is evidence that at least the ancient city of Aleppo and Crac des Chevaliers have been used for military purposes, subjected to direct shelling and targeted explosions. Intangible cultural heritage, including cultural practices, performing arts, and more, is also exposed to serious damage due to social fragmentation, displacement, and migration. It is vital that the media raise public awareness about the crisis of Syria's cultural heritage, said Francesco Bandarin, Assistant UNESCO Director General for Culture. He said, art traders and buyers must be made aware of the risk of illicit trafficking and that international mafia organizations are using the crisis to sell both genuine and fake artifacts from the country. So he had another concern about devastation. And the ruination of native culture and accumulated historical culture in the land of Syria. Okay, folks. I expect this following piece to be the piece de resistance of the show, the big climax here. It's 4:26, by the way, 4:26 p.m., 1626 hours Pacific time. I have mentioned in the past my adoration and appreciation of an organization entitled If Americans Knew, namely www.ifamericansknew.org. First, I'll read the mission statement, their mission statement, and then I'll get into this particular piece. If Americans Knew mission statement: in a democracy, the ultimate responsibility for a nation's actions rests with its citizens, the top rung of government, the entity with the ultimate power of governance is the asserted will of the people. Therefore, in any democracy, it is essential that the citizens be fully and accurately informed. In the United States, currently the most powerful nation on earth, it is even more essential that its citizens receive complete and undistorted information on topics of importance, so that they may yield their extraordinary power with wisdom and intelligence. Unfortunately, such information is not always forthcoming. Oof. Forgot I had a reading lamp here. And I am, for once, actually reading from a piece of paper. I'm not on the computer screens, hence the need for a reading lamp. Continuing with mission statement. Unfortunately, such information is not always forthcoming. The mission of If Americans Knew is to inform and educate the American public on issues of major significance that are unreported, underreported, or misreported in the American media. It is our belief that when Americans know the facts on a subject, they will, in the final analysis, act in accordance with morality, justice, and the best interests of their nation and of the world. With insufficient information or distorted information, they may do the precise opposite. It is the mission of If Americans Knew to ensure that this does not happen, that the information on which Americans base their actions is complete, accurate, and undistorted by conscious or unconscious bias, by lies of either commission or omission, or by pressures exerted by powerful special interest groups. It is our goal to supply the information essential to those responsible for the actions of the strongest nation on earth, the American people. I will grant you right away that what it is, topic-wise, that attracts me to this organization, If Americans Knew, is their unrelenting reference to documented facts, statistics, and witness reports on the matter of Israel and Palestine. I've only been drawn and have only seen on their website and other materials matters relating to Israel and Palestine and the conflict, the ongoing conflict there. The mission statement does not specify that they have anything to do with either Israel or Palestine or anything to do with the Middle East. So, until I come across information that is not on that general topic, the Middle East, Israel, Palestine, the Holy Land, until I come across anything that has to do with other than that topic, I will assume that they are not yet talking about other topics. But for my purposes, for the time being, I don't mind that they're not talking about other stuff. This is a 20-odd page pamphlet. Let's make it 17 or 19 pages. Entitled, The Staggering Cost of Israel to Americans. By If Americans Knew. Little biographical information, other important basic stuff. This If Americans Knew report updates the groundbreaking work by Richard Curtis. His 1998 analysis, The Cost of Israel to Americans, was originally published in the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. Richard Curtis, following military service in World War II, served as 30 years as a career foreign service officer. He received the U.S. Information Agency Superior Honor Award and the Edward R. Murrow Award for Excellence in Public Diplomacy, the USIA's highest professional recognition. Upon retirement, Mr. Curtis co-founded the American Educational Trust, which produces the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. He is also the author of two books on U.S.-Middle East relations. A more extensive bio can be read at blah, blah, blah. Pamela Olson was a president scholar at Stanford University, 1998 to 2002, with a major in physics, a minor in political science, and 1,600 GRE scores. Before coming to IAK, if Americans knew, Olson lived and worked in the West Bank of Palestine, worked as a researcher in Moscow, Siberia, and China, and was a research analyst at the Institute for Defense Analysis. She is the author of Fast Times in Palestine, published by Seal Press. This edition of the brochure here, published March 2014. Statistics will continue to be updated online at ifamericansknew.org. And indeed it is the website of If Americans Knew, where I fell into great respect for their ability to maintain proper, current, and appropriate statistics concerning the conflict in Palestine and Israel. Again, statistics will continue to be updated online at www.ifamericansknew.org. Okay, let's do this. The staggering cost of Israel to Americans. Note their constant adherence to statistics. Israel has a population of approximately 7.7 million people, or a million fewer than the state of New Jersey. It is among the world's most affluent nations, with a per capita income similar to that of the European Union. Israel's unemployment rate of 6.8% is much better than America's 7.3%. Much better than America's at 7.3%, and Israel's net trade earnings and payments is ranked 30th in the world, while the United States sits at a dismal 193rd. Yet, Israel receives more of America's foreign aid budget than any other nation. The United States has, in fact, given more aid to Israel than it has to all the countries of sub-Saharan Africa, Latin America, and the Caribbean combined, which have a total population of over a billion people, compared to Israel's 7.7 million. And foreign aid is just one component of the staggering cost of our relationship with Israel. Given the tremendous cost, it is critical to examine why we lavish so much aid on Israel and whether it is worth Americans' hard-earned tax dollars. But first, let's take a look at what our relationship with Israel truly costs. Before the Iraq War in 2003, direct foreign aid, according to the Congressional Research Service, the amount of official U.S. aid to Israel since its founding in 1948 tops $118 billion, and in the past few decades it has been on the order of $3.1 billion per year. In 2013, for example, this amounted to over $8.5 million every single day. That's 8.5 million every day. But this money is only part of the story. For one thing, Israel gets all of its aid money at the start of each year rather than in quarterly installments like other countries. This is significant. It means that Israel can start earning interest on the money right away. Interest paid by the U.S. since Israel invests these funds in U.S. Treasury notes. In addition, because the U.S. government operates at a deficit, it must borrow money in order to give it to Israel and then pay interest on it all year. Together, these cost U.S. taxpayers more than $100 million every year. Israel is also the only recipient of U.S. military aid that is allowed to use a significant portion annually to purchase products made by Israeli companies instead of U.S. companies. The costs to Americans caused by this unique perk, are discussed below. In addition, the U.S. gives roughly $1.6 billion per year, that's $1.6 billion per year, to Egypt and Jordan in aid packages arranged largely in exchange for peace treaties with Israel. The treaties don't include justice for Palestinians and are therefore deeply unpopular with the local populations. On top of this, the U.S. promises more than $400 million to the Palestinian Authority each year. That's $400 million to the PA, much of it used to rebuild infrastructure destroyed by Israel and to bolster an economy stifled by the Israeli occupation. Whoops. This would be unnecessary if Israel were to end the occupation and allow the Palestinians to build a functioning and self-sustaining economy. Let me read that entire paragraph again. I think it is quite central and pivotal, very pivotal point to this whole discussion here. On top of this, the U.S. promises more than $400 million to the Palestinian Authority each year, much of it used to rebuild infrastructure destroyed by Israel and to bolster an economy stifled by the Israeli occupation. This would be unnecessary if Israel were to end the occupation and allow the Palestinians to build a functioning and self-sustaining economy. Yet there's still much more to the story because parts of U.S. aid to Israel are buried in the budgets of various U.S. agencies, mostly the Department of Defense. For example, since at least 2006, the American defense budget has included between $132 and $479 million per year for missile defense programs in Israel. How many of us knew that? Because we hear about the $3.1 million every year. There are all these additional sort of hidden costs. Okay, continuing with this report. In all, direct U.S. disbursements to Israel are higher than to any other country, even though Israelis only make up 0.1% of the world's population. On average, Israelis receive 7,000 times more U.S. foreign aid per capita than other people throughout the world. 7,000 times more U.S. foreign aid per capita, despite the fact that Israel is one of the world's most affluent nations. And that number rises significantly when one considers disbursements to Egypt, Jordan, and the Palestinian Authority and defense spending on behalf of Israel. Additional ad hoc support for Israel. Dr. Thomas Stauffer, a Harvard economist and Middle East studies professor who twice served in the executive office of the president, wrote a comprehensive report about all components of the relationship of Israel's cost to American taxpayers for the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs in 2003. He wrote, "Another element is ad hoc support for Israel, which is not part of the formal foreign aid programs. No comprehensive compilation of U.S. support for Israel has been publicly released. No comprehensive compilation of U.S. support for Israel has been publicly released. Additional known items include loan guarantees, special contracts for Israeli firms, legal and illegal transfers of marketable U.S. military technology, de facto exemption from U.S. trade protection provisions, and discounted sales or free transfers of, quote, surplus U.S. military equipment. An unquantifiable element is the trade and other aid given to Romania and Russia to facilitate Jewish migration to Israel. This has accumulated to many billions of dollars," end quote. That's a quotation from Dr. Thomas Stauffer back in 2003. Israel has often used its privileged access to U.S. military technology against both the U.S. government and U.S. corporate interests. According to the Associated Press, in 2002, quote, in France, Turkey, the Netherlands, and Finland. Israeli companies have edged such U.S. firms as Raytheon, Northrop Grumman, and General Atomics out of arms deals worth hundreds of millions of dollars in recent years. The irony, experts say, is that tens of billions of U.S. tax dollars and transfers of American military technology helped create and nurture Israel's industry, in effect subsidizing a foreign competitor, end quote. The AP article quoted a vice president at the Aerospace Industries Association of America, who bluntly said, "We give them money to build stuff for themselves, and the U.S. taxpayer gets nothing in return." Meanwhile, according to the Christian Science Monitor, Israel has also, quote, blocked some major U.S. arms sales, such as F-15 fighter aircraft, to Saudi Arabia in the mid-1980s. That cost $40 billion over 10 years. End quote. Even worse, Israeli weapons, quote, buttress the arsenals of nations such as China that the United States considers strategic competitors, alarming U.S. military planners, the Associated Press article went on to report. Quote, in 2001, U.S. surveillance planes flying along China's coast were threatened by Chinese fighter jets armed with Israeli missiles. Had Chinese fighter pilots been given the order to fire, they could have brought down the U.S. planes with Israeli Python 3 missiles. U.S. defense chiefs say Israel sold China the missiles without informing the United States. New subheading here, lost jobs, trade, and standing. One of the most devastating indirect costs of the U.S. relationship with Israel was the Arab oil embargo of 1973. The Arab states imposed the boycott in protest of U.S. support of Israel during the 1973 war, in which Arab countries attempted to reclaim lands that Israel had invaded and occupied in 1967. Quote, Washington's intervention triggered the Arab oil embargo, which cost the U.S. doubly. First, due to the oil shortfall, the U.S. lost about $300 billion to $600 billion in GDP, gross domestic product. And second, the U.S. was saddled with another $415 billion in higher oil import costs, wrote Stauffer in the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. Then there's the cost and lost jobs. Quote, U.S. policy and trade sanctions reduced U.S. exports to the Middle East about $5 billion a year, costing 70,000 or so American jobs, Stauffer estimates, and goes on to say, not requiring Israel to use its U.S. aid to buy American goods, as is usual in foreign aid, costs another 125,000 jobs, end quote. But perhaps the most damaging cost to the United States has been its loss of standing in the Arab and Muslim worlds, where U.S. largesse towards Israel as it commits human rights violations provokes deep resentment. Quote, to many of the world's Muslims, it places the U.S. taxpayer on the Israeli side of its conflicts with Arabs, observed the Associated Press article. According to Harvard professor Stephen Walt, quote, the 9/11 Commission reported that 9/11 plotter Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's subquote, animus toward the United States stemmed not from his experiences there as a student, but rather from his violent disagreement with U.S. foreign policy favoring Israel, end subquote. Other anti-American terrorists, such as Ramzi Youssef, who led the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center in the basement there, in the car garage, have offered similar explanations for their anger toward the United States, end of quotation. There are many more potential categories of costs that are even more difficult to quantify. All in all, Stauffer estimates that Israel cost the U.S. about $1.6 trillion between 1973 and 2003 alone. That 30-year period. More than twice the cost of the Vietnam War. I'll read it again. All in all, Stauffer estimates that Israel costs the United States about $1.6 trillion, with a T, trillion dollars, between 1973 and 2003 alone, more than twice the cost of the Vietnam War. More than twice the cost of the Vietnam War. Costs since Stauffer's study in 2003. We will not be able to finish this article, but I'm going to continue to read here. By the way, if you want to get your phone call in to the Mideast Migraine Show, call me at area code 831-427-3772. That's 427-3772. Enough time to talk about this. The costs in Stauffer's study in 2003. Israel's cost to American taxpayers has remained high since Stauffer's 2003 study. The U.S. currently gives Israel an average of $3 billion a year in military aid under an agreement signed by the Bush administration to transfer $30 billion to Israel over 10 years starting in 2009. That would be the George W. Bush administration, Bush 43. All of the other extras and costs remain, and in some cases have increased, since 2003. For example, quote, despite a tough economic climate and expected U.S. budget cuts, including drastic cuts to the U.S. military budget, U.S. lawmakers will provide $236 million in fiscal 2012 for the Israeli development of three missile defense programs, reported Israeli newspaper Haaretz. In addition, the U.S. government, quote, has provided $205 million to support the Iron Dome, manufactured by Israel's state-owned Rafael Advanced Defense Systems Limited. The system uses small radar-guided missiles to blow up in mid-air Katyusha-style rockets with ranges of 3 miles to 45 miles, as well as mortar bombs. Legislation moving through the Republican-controlled U.S. House of Representatives would give Israel additional $680 million for the Iron Dome system through 2015. As if, as many experts believe, the U.S. would not have invaded Iraq without intense and sustained pressure from Washington insiders who advocate actively on behalf of Israel. This adds yet another dimension of staggering cost to the equation. Quote, hundreds of billions of dollars, 4,000 plus U.S. and allied fatalities, untold tens of thousands of Iraqi deaths, and many thousands of other U.S., allied, and Iraqi casualties, end quote, according to retired U.S. Foreign Service officer Cheryl MacArthur, Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz, and Harvard professor Linda Bilmes put the cost of the Iraq War at over $3 trillion, and incalculably more if you take into account the opportunity costs of the resources spent on this unproductive war. For example, higher oil prices due to the war have had a devastating impact on America's economy, and so have the surging federal debt and the servicing of that debt. Without the war, the 2008 financial crisis almost certainly would not have been as severe, and the Afghanistan war most likely would have been shorter, cheaper, and more effective. The Israel lobby and partisans are currently gunning for a war with Iran with the same zeal they showed in the run-up to the 2003 invasion of Iraq. By all estimates, the costs of a war with Iran will be much higher than the Iraq war. In addition to the loss of life, and analysts predict, for example, that if Iran's oil production were taken out of the world market, gas prices would rise 25 to 70%. If the Straits of Hormuz, straits adjacent to Iran, through which 20% of the world's oil production passes on a daily basis, if the Straits of Hormuz were attacked or blockaded, the cost of oil would skyrocket to a level never seen before, and the economic recession or depression that followed would be nothing short of, quote, apocalyptic, according to Matthew Iglesias, writing for Slate. Indeed, we're only on the middle of page 6 of this 15-odd report here from If Americans Knew. I will start this entire report afresh at the top of next Monday's program of Mideast Migraines. Mideast Migraines comes to you every Monday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Pacific Daylight Time. That's 1,500 hours. It actually comes to you at 1,500 hours, 3 o'clock, whether it's daylight time or standard time. That saying PDT or PST is a mere formality as far as I'm concerned. This is your opportunity. This is not just, or at least it shouldn't be, just me sitting here shoveling a bunch of words and sentences and facts and statistics and documentations out to you. There may, for example, not be a lot of people listening online right now. They may or may not. I know there are some of you who listen to your old-fashioned radio sets to 101.3 FM. The show is certainly available to you without the need for a PC, mobile device, etc. But you may listen at your pleasure to either outlet. Don't forget the Saturday edition of Mideast Migraines. Every Saturday morning, starting at 11 a.m., going until 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I am currently reading Congressman Paul Finley's book entitled They Dare to Speak Out, People and Institutions Confront Israel's Lobby. Fascinating, eye-opening book about the power of the Israel lobby in Washington, D.C. and its influence on American governance and on our national budget, on decisions that make or break the budget. Not to mention making or breaking foreign wars that we engage in for what may turn out to be highly questionable purposes to begin with, as in, what's the real story of 9/11? Who was really behind 9/11? I haven't even scratched the surface of that topic. But there's no question in my mind that there's so far much more to the 9/11 story than what meets the eye of the typical American, or typical world citizen for that matter. Very effective activity, very effective planning. Okay, this is the end of our show. This is Rin to Wheel, saying goodbye until next Monday, or if you're lucky enough to be near your device, appropriate device, at Saturday at 11 a.m., tune in then. Thank you for listening. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz.